Welcome to the Admin Happen Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we are back for another episode of the Admin Happen Podcast. This is episode 22. And there's all three of us this week. Jerry's feeling a lot better, so he's decided to come along today.
Back from the dead.
He's back from the dead. So what's everyone been up to? Especially Jerry. What's Jerry been up to apart from being on a deathbed? What else have you been doing?
Well, I've been to Amsterdam. That was nice.
Oh right. Well, that's.
Yeah, it didn't involve much techie stuff. I was ill before I went to Amsterdam, which is stress, not afterwards. Only a little bit ill afterwards.
Was that self-induced?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Not my absence from the last podcast. That was just a virus or something. Not a computer virus. What have I been up to? I've been completing the hardware refresh in my house, which involved my NAS box and fitting some new hard drives to it, copying data over and putting a new firmware on it. I actually did the firmware first, but so that was fun. I've got a lot more storage and it's raided, and I feel a lot happier about everything. So that completes my new hardware for the next few years, I should think. Just other than that, just a few stuff with my freelance clients, a few bits and bobs. We can talk about that later, or we can talk about that now.
We can talk about it now.
Okay, well, probably the most interesting thing I've got going on at the moment is it's kind of been going on for a while with this one client, but he wants to put in this bit of monitoring software. It's called Isinga. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but it's like Nagios. It was a fork of Nagios in the open source world. That's when you take the code, because it's open source, and go in a different direction with it. So it's like a fork in the road, if you like. And they've gone a bit further away from the original Nagios code base to do this new kind of thing. And the reason that I'm using it for this client is because he's got this thing which quite a lot of sort of IT services companies have, where they want to monitor lots of different sites and have it all reporting back to a central server. And this looks like it might do the trick. Nagios could kind of do that, but not very well, and it was a bit of a hack and didn't or was a bit of a nightmare to set up and administer. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. One of the things as well with this is I'm using a VPN to communicate with the machines on this guy's site. So that's a bit of a first for me. It seems to work no problem. Set it up on my laptop, on my computer, and put in the details, and off you go.
So is it a site-to-site VPN you set up on your VPS then? Or is it just from like one server to another server, this VPN? Are you using like OpenVPN or something? Or
no, it's PPTP, which I understand is not, you know, it's...
That's not very secure.
Not the best thing security-wise, but I'm using SSH inside that, so
yeah.
It's fairly secure. It was mainly because this guy, I think that the techie guy's on holiday, and this guy doesn't want to make too many changes to his firewall, so he's not willing to forward the ports that I need, that I would usually need, which is port 22, because... his phone systems are on the same firewall, so he doesn't want to muck around. So I've been using this VPN. which works well, but I can't use it from behind my work file, which is a bit of a bummer. I was trying to do that today, trying to use Tunnel SSH through my work firewall and then into a VPN, but didn't work. A bit too complicated. Interestingly, the sort of satellite sites that he's going to be monitoring, he's going to use Raspberry Pi, and we'll put an Isinga sort of cut down instance on there, which will be talking back to the central server. And I'm hoping to use Ansible to configure all that, both to configure these little satellite Raspberry Pis, and to do the actual configuration of the monitoring, because if it's anything like Nagios, I haven't got to that stage yet, but if it's anything like Nagios, it's pretty complicated, and it could be simplified with something like Ansible. But I'll report back on that in weeks to come.
What was that again? Hans or something, did you say?
Ansible. It's a configuration management. It's like, if anyone's heard of Puppet, it's a bit like that.
Right, okay, but it's not like Puppet, or is it just like a branch or something? Or,
well, it's actually quite different from Puppet, but it kind of does the same thing. It configures a load of Linux machines from a central location. So it's what I use for my client's machine. So if I ever do something, then I will generally turn that into an Ansible, like they're called playbooks or roles. So if I do something once, I don't have to do it again. Or if I want to do it again, I just point this code at a different server. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to do a load of steps again, which is really the goal behind config management systems. Okay. So there's that. That's, as you might have gathered, the most interesting one at the moment. Another thing that's going on is a client of mine, his server is doing brute force attacks against other people's servers, which is fun. So what's obviously happened there is someone's got onto one of his sites, and there's a bit of malicious code in there, which is at a given time sending brute force attacks, which is basically attempting to log into well-known CMSs like WordPress or Joomla, because you can basically go to any domain, and the login, the path to the login is always the same, and you can just try a load of different passwords in the hope of getting in. Mm-hmm. I'm more used to being on the other end of this, where you're defending against those brute force logins, which I would use something like fail to ban for that, which generally you can write rules to discover that kind of activity and then block it using the local firewall on the server. Now this is on the other end of it, so I've got to try and discover what's sending out these attacks, which is a bit of a challenge. I haven't quite got there yet, but again, maybe check back in a few weeks, I might have solved it.
That's interesting. I've never had a client say to me, help, my computer is infecting other people's computers. Mm-hmm. It's normally the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's but surely then your experience in trying to block it is going to help you in trying to prevent it. You know.
Yeah. But the problem is, a web server often talks to other web servers, so it's because of things like, as I've discovered, just talking is APIs and things. So Eventbrite is one that I'm seeing in the logs that I've set up. And something called Akismet, which is a comment spam thing, so a comment spam filtering. So when someone puts a comment on a blog, that gets pointed to a website to basically filter it, see if it's spam or not. So I'm just outputting these logs at the moment to see what his server is doing and who it's talking to. But even when I've done that, there's, you know, tens of websites on his server, so narrowing it down to what website is actually doing it is It's going to be fun. But
so he hasn't got some sort of spy bot or something on his server then somewhere then, like.
I think it tends to be like a sort of botnet, so it's under control of someone else, yeah. And they'll find a vulnerability in the bit of website code. Because there's areas and CMSs where you can upload things, and if you can just put a bit of code there, which will take a command from an external command and control server, and then it will just do these, you know, just run the code from a compromised server, and in the hope of compromising more servers. That's how it works generally. Normally, you can, if it's other sort of ones like that that I've come across have been sending emails, and if they're sending emails through the server's main mail server, then that'll show up in the logs, and you can trace that back to what script was sending the mail. But this is different. It's a TCP based attack. So if anyone's listening and has got any tips, I'll be glad to hear it.
Okay, interesting. But how did you find out that this was happening though?
Someone complained.
All right.
So but, helpfully, it's got the exact times that these attacks are happening. So I've at least got something to go on. But unfortunately, I don't know the IPs that are being attacked or anything like that. So. It's a bit of guesswork, but I'll get there in the end.
So, what have you been up to, Andy?
Well, I haven't been up to anything too interesting up to this point, but the one thing I wanted to bring up is the job that I'm going to do tomorrow, which we have talked about briefly already on the show. So, actually, before I go and do it tomorrow, I thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of have a look and see if there's any good sort of game plan for me to do tomorrow. So this is the we've got some little diagrams in the show notes. We'll have to put them up on the show notes if we can. So if anyone wants to look at them, they can. But we're basically changing this network round to speed things up a bit. We're putting the NAS drive in and gigabit switches and that. So I'm going down there at I'll be there for 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to make a start. So I'm a little bit I don't suppose there's any need to be, but I'm a little bit apprehensive in what I'm going to do and how I'm going to go about it, and also once it's all plugged in, how I'm going to deal with the data. What can I do? I want to set up some kind of remote thing as well, so when I leave the place tomorrow night, then I can access it remotely to get any of the rest of the work done. So can you two both see the diagrams in the show notes?
So I can see one which says the wireless devices are 54 meg at the moment. There's 100 meg, and you've got a Roy's PC, Chris's PC, and Steve's PC. On Chris's PC, he's got two shared drives. They're USB drives.
They are USB, yes.
And then you've got Steve PC, who's got a USB backup drive on his.
Yeah, he's got so there's a terabyte. It's actually a USB 3 drive, but it's plugged into
What's
a USB 2
port.
What's the
buffer bit on it? What does the red bar?
Oh, I put this on the diagram for client to kind of understand that is a slow
bottleneck
bit.
Then
a bottleneck, yeah, that's the word, yeah. Because as you can imagine, see where it says shared drives, I think they call them the K drive and the M drive, I think they are. So they're just map drives in Windows for the other. There's actually another computer on that list as well, which is just the same as Roy's. It's got nothing plugged into it, but there's another PC on it. So everybody constantly all day long is trying to access those shared drives. So as you can imagine, they're all on a 100 megabit network. Yeah. The router's 100 megabit. Yeah. The network cards are all 100 megabit. And the shared drives are USB 2.
Okay.
So, that is, well, you can imagine why they are seeing it slow as well. Another thing they do as well, which is they have a lot of video files. Some of the stuff that they actually do, some of the work they do, have got cameras there.
Okay.
So they actually record some of the stuff. So they make movie files out of it. And those files sometimes can be quite big, you know, up into the gigabytes. So they're being copied and shared onto the USB drives. So you can imagine a couple of gigabyte files through that system takes a long time to copy, okay, transfer, buffer up and stuff like that. So that's how it is at the moment. And there's another aspect to this as well, which is a bit of most kind of worried about, if you like. Remember, this particular setup has been talked about before on this show when we did a show about VPN. Mm-hmm. And me and you, we set up this VPN tunnel between these two sites, didn't we? Now, that was on an ACT database.
Yeah.
And that ACT database is on where it says Chris PC.
Right, okay.
Which I believe was on 1.6 IP address. So the VPN pointed to 1.6.
Yeah.
So that has to be took into account as well, because those databases are going to be moved onto the NAS drive. So I've got to figure out how I'm going to do that at the
minute. Okay.
So that's where we are at the minute. And understand, if people are listening and aren't looking at this picture, then it may be a little bit confusing. But the gist of it is the shared drives are USB on one computer. It's a 100 megabit network, and everyone's shared through a Windows share of USB drives. Okay. So the plan to move ahead, which is what we're doing tomorrow, is to we've got a gigabit switch. I've got 4 gigabit network cards to go into each of the computers, and then the NAS drive, which is also a gigabit NAS drive, plugs into the switch as well. So the idea is there's no shared USB drives. There's no USB drives at all. Apart from the NAS drive will have a terabyte USB backup drive plugged into it, which we could set up to back up or synchronize or mm-hmm. however it works. So so if anyone's looking at that diagram now, this is the second diagram, then this is the initial plan. So if anyone's got any ideas of how this could be maybe done slightly differently or anything like that, then you better hurry up and write in, because we're doing it tomorrow.
So
that'll be after before we've actually released the show. So
it will, yeah.
If you can just get a time machine, in fact, you can make a time machine out of a DeLorean if you like, and
that's it.
Go back to Andy tomorrow, find out where he's going, and then go stop,
don't do it.
So you've got, are they got a new router going in there, or is the old router staying?
Oh, the router that they've got is, well, they've got, in fact, do you remember doing it? There's a Draytech. Yeah. That Draytech staying, because that has the VPN set up on it with all the office, which we're not touching at the minute.
That's quite a decent router, though, I imagine, the Draytech.
Yeah, we used it, didn't we? I mean, I can't remember what show number it was on, but it was one of our earlier shows, wasn't it, when we talked about how we did that.
So, is this the site where they're going? Are they moving into a new office, are they? Or
they will be, but they don't know when they're moving yet. The place that we're going to move to wanted silly money for letting it out or renting it out to them. So they're not moving there anymore. But they are going to move. But this has become such a problem that they said, right, we'll get all the bits for it now, and then when we move, we take everything with us and plug it all in exactly the same when we get there.
Okay.
So,
I think you're going to see a big improvement having that gigabit switch in there, because you know, before you got the router doing all the, I mean, it's a decent router, so it shouldn't be too bad, but you're taking all the network traffic away from, you know, isolating it to just the PCs and the switch, which is really good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true, but I mean, but I've always considered those shared drives to be the biggest bottleneck.
Mm.
And when you consider, when you look on the diagram, that crisp PC, it's not like it's a Windows server where no one's touching it.
Mm.
You know, somebody is using that all day, every day. They're watching these videos that they make online. They're accessing databases. They've got five browsers open. They've got Excel open. They've got all sorts of stuff going on.
Mm.
And people are trying to share through a network drive through it as well.
My recommendation is the first thing I do in the morning when I get there is put the switch in, get everyone running,
right,
put the new NICs in the machines. So you're running you're running at a gig everywhere. Set the NAS up. First thing I'll do is probably create the user accounts on the NAS, because I'm guessing that each user logs on with their own username and password, I'm guessing, separate username and passwords on the PCs, or
there's no domain or anything.
There's no domain. No. So they're basically Windows Home.
But are they logging on with like a username and password kind of thing, if you see what I mean?
I would say just like a local one.
Steve, because you're going to basically need to set those users up on that NAS box. If you want to do that auditing thing, at least if you do it right from the start, you can then set those usernames and passwords up on the Synology box.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And then I'd create different shares of different things on that NAS box. So I'd probably create a share with users to start off with, where users can store their data. So have a user share, and then in there put a folder called Roy, Chris, and Steve. And then another folder called shared documents or whatever, all their shared things. And then the third one would like called CCTV or something, so that you're not, so that you've so you can keep all those big files away from everything else. So if you want to do backups to like that USB hard drive, you probably can configure it by the share level, and then you don't have to worry about copying all the CCTV stuff to the cloud or whatever, what you're going to do in the future, if you see what I mean.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
What raid level is the NAS going to be? Is it RAID 5?
Well, that's the next question, actually, because it's a 2-bay RAID device.
RAID 5 won't be an option then. It'd just be RAID 0 or RAID 1.
Right. Well, what we want it to do is, I've got 2 1-terabyte hard drives to go into it. They're not even put in it yet.
Yeah.
So there's 2 of them going into it. And they have a 1-terabyte USB backup for it. So the idea was to, because I can never remember with these RAIDs, to have a 1-terabyte drive copied, so it's copied on both of them. Is that RAID 1? I'm trying to...
So that's mirroring. So when something gets written to one, it gets written to the other, basically.
I mean, they don't need massive amounts of... I mean, a terabyte is well enough for them. Even though they've got these big video files, they don't keep them for a long time.
Mm.
So there are big files getting shared across the network, but a lot of them are shared, copied, looked at, deleted.
That's another good reason to have that third share for CCTV, because it can be just don't bother backing that.
Yeah. So if I have that as a mirrored one, then that, I mean, I'm saying that as a form of backup, you see. That's another form of backup.
Well, it's not a backup.
It's an insurance against losing a drive rather than a backup.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So if you did lose the drive, or a drive, well, for a start off, it would carry on operating, then, wouldn't it? It would operate on the other one.
Yeah, it would.
And give you a chance to replace the faulty one. Okay.
So it's basically mirroring, Andy. So you've got 2 drives, and when it writes something to one drive, or someone's writing to the NAS, it would write it to both drives. So Whereas RAID 0 is just where you have it, where it's just spanned to two disks, so it could put your data on any of the disks. So you'd get a two, with your 1 terabyte drive, you'd get a 2 terabyte, which is actually faster. Is it like faster because you can read in, because you can write to it, and it can read it really quick as well because it's spanning between.
We can read a bit of data of both drives, can't we? And there is another one, it's JBOD, where it basically takes the two disks and concatenates them, so just joins one onto the other and makes it like one big volume. So you probably finally got JBOD as well, but I wouldn't use it because you lose one drive, you lose a load of data.
Same with the mirror. Sorry, not mirror.
I saw this crazy video on YouTube a while ago where they had, I can't remember what they did it with, a RAID, and they had about 20 SSD drives. How would they do it?
I saw that. RAID Zero.
So, RAID Zero with 20 USB drives, and it was the most quickest instant thing I've ever seen in my life. Didn't they like open 20 instances of Excel, and they all opened within half a second or something? It was crazy. But that's because the span of the disk, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it can read a bit off each one. So I suppose the more you span, the quicker it would get with it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, at my day job, they do, what they do is they do hardware RAID 5, I think, or 6. So you've got redundancy on the hardware. And then with those, say you have two hardware RAID 5 volumes, you put a RAID 0 across those two volumes, so you get the speed, but also with the hardware redundancy.
Is that RAID 10 or RAID 50?
Well, it's RAID 5 or RAID 6 on the hardware, and then RAID 0 as a on the software.
Yeah, I think so that's classified as RAID 10 or RAID 50. That's what it's called.
Okay, right.
Oh, I see. RAID 5-0, well, maybe 5-0.
Well, you get RAID 1+0, where it's mirrored, but it's striped and mirrored, or 0+1, where it's striped and mirrored, and or mirrored and then striped. So,
What's the difference between striped and mirrored?
Striped and mirrored, you have two disks, and then you write to both of those. So you've got the redundancy of the RAID 1, but you're writing to both RAID 1s at the same time, so you get the speed. Right. Yeah.
So you need 4 disks for that, would you?
Yeah, at least 4 disks. Oh, okay. You can do multiples of 2. Yeah. And then there is, you can do 0+1 as well, where you the opposite of what I just said. I think I've had a few too many beers. I can't quite picture it.
You can see how that would get very expensive very quickly, wouldn't it?
With
more and more hard drives, and
so you've got the
RAID.
Got your third hard drive, which is your USB hard drive backup device, which is where you're going to be backing up from your NAS to the drives. Yeah. So let's say if you use one disk and use another disk, or if you lose NAS completely, then you've got the USB backup drive to restore that data to.
Yeah.
So quickly, when you said that Solidity box, remember to set up the email alerting on it so you can get alerts on it. So if a disk fails or whatever, you get an alert for that. The only thing I'll be worried about is that the only thing what would worry me about it is the Sage. The ACK database, because I'm quite sure that ACK database is actually a SQL Express database, which I don't think you're going to be able to easily move to the NAS drive. So what I would do tomorrow, if it was me, I'd move all the other documents I share, everything over to that NAS drive, set everyone would share drive, show how they get the thing. And I would leave the Sage database or the ACK database where it is, and then on Monday give ACK a call and say, where do you move? How does it work? Is it a SQL database? Because if I remember correctly, it's like it had got a database, like a little SQL Express instance. So, and then you've got the help of not mucking up their Sage software on their ACK software on a Saturday when there's no support.
Yeah, which I'm guessing that's a good point. I mean, that's the bit I was most worried about. Yeah, because if they are open on a Saturday and I have time, I will call them. But But the other thing I've got to realise, I've got to make sure as well, is when I leave there on Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, or however long I'm there for, when the rest of them arrive back to work on Monday morning again, basically everything works. They can access the ACT database, they can get their emails, they can go on the internet. They may need a little bit of tuition, if you like, on where the new shared files are. Luckily, one of the lads that work there, his name's Chris, who's that PC that you've been looking at. he is fairly au fait with all the terminology, and he kind of knows roughly what's going on. He's actually going to be with me there tomorrow as well. If anything, we're going to be pulling out desks and pulling out computers and unplugging stuff and all this kind of stuff. So apart from the fact he's got to be there to let me in and kind of, I think he's just there to, I don't know, keep me company for the day or something, or give me a hand with some bits, then at least then if we set up the shared drives or whatever, there's another question. We'd just do that as a map drive, just like I did with the other, just the same sort of thing, and he points it to the NAS device instead. And we could probably keep the same letters as well than that they're used to. And then if he's there and he sees how it works, so he understands what happens, and when the others come in on Monday morning, he can show them as well. So I don't have to be there on Monday to show them. And then at some point as well, I'll have to put some remote software on some of it somewhere, so I can, after I get home on Saturday, if there's any other bits that I can do, I can do it remotely, say on Saturday night or Sunday.
You like put Teams on a PC so you can jump on it remotely, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think a TeamViewer is already on that Chris PC. So, because I've jumped on there a few times. That's the plan. So basically, I think my actions to tomorrow just should be get the hardware sorted out, get the gigabit switch sorted out, get the NIC card sorted out. I'm not going to mess with none of the IP ranges, or the DHCP is going to be changing or anything like that. So after we've got all the cards and the switch set up and it all goes on the internet and everything, then the next thing to do is set up the NAS.
Set a static IP address on that NAS as well.
Yes, definitely. I'll find a convenient number to set it as a static IP. And then I'll go about setting up that.
With that USB drive, it's 1 terabyte. But if you're doing backups, you fill up the NAS, you will fill up the backup drive as well. So you won't be able to do any kind of versioning, or you won't be able to say roll back to, I don't know, last week's backup of a file. That's the only thing I was thinking of about.
Oh, I see. Well, does that depend on how much data they've got? Well, if the NAS is full, you mean?
It depends how the backups work, for a start, because, I mean, I don't know how Synology backups work, whether you can sort of do incremental or whatever on that. But, I mean, it might be worth thinking of getting a slightly bigger backup drive, because they're pretty cheap, aren't they?
Yeah, they've already got one, because when I was doing the quote for them, and I said, oh, we're going to put 2 terabyte drives in the NAS, and they said, oh, it's all right, we've got one of them already. I said, what exactly have you got? And they were talking about a USB drive. I said, ah, right, that's no good for going in the NAS. We're talking about going in the NAS.
Rip the back, the 1 terabyte drive from inside the USB drive. But
well, conceivably,
better to get a brand new one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is new. I mean, you got this about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
That USB drive. So I said, okay, yeah, it's no problem. I said, we can still use it. And we're still going to use it, because that's going to be for that. And I'm also going to look at the cloud backup as well.
Yeah.
So what I'm going for ultimately is the the copy on the two RAID hard drives, the USB backup, and a cloud backup. That's what I'm going for the backup solution.
It's a good strategy to have an off-site backup, definitely.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, they had absolutely nothing, and it was only a month ago that they got this USB backup drive. And that Chris actually phoned me because they were talking about backing up the stuff. And this is where, wait until I tell you this, it took them 23 hours to back it up. And it wasn't because it was particularly big, it was just slow. So I said, well, you can't have a daily backup that takes 23 hours to back up, can you really? Yeah.
I mean, you can with something like CrashPlan. I think I mentioned this before. You can have a USB drive at someone's house and have CrashPlan running on the computer at home, as long as it's always on, obviously. And you can back up between the two CrashPlan instances for free. So it's an off-site backup.
Well, yeah. This is what we're doing here. There's another office of theirs, which is in a different location, which we've got connected on a VPN, and they've basically said if this works pretty good at the one place, do you want to do exactly the same in the other place?
I heard you talking about having the syncing between the two NAS boxes.
Right. Yeah, is that what you mean?
No. Well, yeah. I mean, that is something you can do, but it's just something that you can do for free with CrashPlan as well. So you can set that up. You basically have a token that you give to both CrashPlan instances, and it will just back up between the two. If Synology do the same thing, I'm sure that's just as good. I mean, I'd roll my own Linux solution using our snapshot, probably, but that's just me.
The other thing I'll do as well, Andy, which you can do, is set up a VPN on the actual router so that you can actually dial in from your house. So you can dial in you being on their network, and then you can access like the NAS and stuff, the admin interface, like you're sitting on their network.
Just through the IP address. Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah. So I couldn't access their PCs from that.
You can you can enable RDP on those machines, and you could RDP onto those machines. So
I can VPN onto their router, and then you're
effectively on their network at that point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Then type the IP address of the of the. But when isn't it that same old story? It's got to be on a different subnet to what I'm on.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what numbers. Oh, I'm keeping it all the same. I'm not messing about with the DHCP or anything like that.
Change your subnet if you need to.
Yeah.
So, what have I been up to?
Have you been up to?
I've been doing a lot with Link this week. I've been investigating Link, which is actually called the Skype for Business now. They renamed it. It's like the community. Right. You know.
Yes, I remember it.
I use it at work. Well,
yeah.
I get people nattering at me all day at work with Link.
I want to introduce it because we've got two main sites and people are talking quite a lot between the sites, and I'm working from home. It's as easy just to instant message people and stuff. So I've been looking at how you set the whole back end of that up. So that's quite interesting. I've been reading a book on it this week, and I hope you might get to go on the course. The other thing interesting I've been talking about is that you heard me talk about the domain names for AD. So like you normally call it .local at the end, like admin.local for your
domain name.
I don't know if you know, but like things like Exchange and stuff, like with 2007, you have a thing called the SAN certificate where you get subject alternative names in the certificate. So you could have like whatever your, like, it'd be like mail.admin.admin.podcast.co.uk is your main domain name. But then you'd have like subdomain names in there for like with Exchange working. You normally, like, with Exchange 2007, you'd have something like the Exchange server name. .admin.local if that is your local domain name. The problem is that since I think it's 2000 or last year, the get my notes up. Since November 2011, 2014, you can't buy SSL certs. Or no, this way, 2011, 2015, this year, you can't buy SSL certificates anymore with .local in them. So, which is a bit annoying, because some of the applications or it means it's just annoying that you can't buy it, kind of thing. So, do you see what I mean with that? Or with the .local.
SSL certificates have to be tied to a given domain name, don't they?
And from 2011, they're not going to let you have a non-rootable domain name, because they can't prove that you own that domain, because obviously you just made it up yourself. So Microsoft, so to get around that, you can have things like you can configure Exchange 2007 to not have the .local in it. You can configure when Exchange 2013, you don't actually have to. You can configure it with a single. I think it's like only two DNS names you have to actually put in that list. And it's not a problem, but. The problem you've got as well is there's a bit of a security risk, because if your PC on the domain is like on the guest Wi-Fi or whatever, or a guest at a hotel, it will try and talk home to domain controllers, because it's trying to find a domain controller to authenticate against. The problem you then got is that you could have a hacker pretend to be your DNS server and then pretend to be your Active Directory domain, and then they can kind of maybe steal your authentication details. But also, because you can't obviously buy .local domain names, the ICANN people who look after the top level domains, like the .uk's or the .com's or whatever, and as you know, they've been releasing more and more lately, haven't they? Like .tv and stuff, etc. And they could in the end start selling .local domains, so someone could buy your internal domain name, if that makes sense. If that just...
that would confuse a lot of things.
Yes. So there's looking.
It's a bit like the 192.168 becoming a public.
Yeah, and you can't buy certificates. I didn't realize you can actually buy SSL certificates for IP addresses, and they won't now issue ones for those IP addresses which are the internal IP addresses. So I've done a load of research on this. I'll put the notes in the show notes. Is that Microsoft have kind of changed their status from Windows 2000, where they recommended the .local. They were recommending that you use something like in our case, like adminadminpodcast.net to keep it separate, so you can .net, you can buy, and you can buy SSL certificates. But the best one I found of that is that you can use the a subdomain of your company name. So I like the idea of having ad.adminadminpodcast.co.uk. So it's just two more letters people have got to remember, or something like internal.adminadminpodcast.co.uk. So that and I've set it up in a demo, and it worked really well. That's something interesting. I'll put the show notes in the document, referring to that. It's just quite interesting.
You can't use self-signed certificates with the Microsoft stuff.
You can do, because you can have internal certificates. So. Like, why do we do at work is you have your own internal certificates, and you basically, it's basically your own CA system. So you basically have you roll out your own root certificate to all the clients, and then you can then, probably when you roll that out to all your clients, and then you can, from like your Exchange server, you can go to CA and say, right, I want the certificate for this .local. Then it will then obviously generate that certificate for .local, and because that root certificate is trusted, it's fine. But the problem you've got is that if you've got any people from external stuff, so if you've got people like from a Windows machine at home, which is not on domain, it hasn't got that root certificate, and they then try and access it, like normal, the main thing like is terminal server certificates, it has a .local on it. You should really use something like a TS gateway server with Windows 2012, and that basically you can put an external certificate on there, like a .co.uk, and that then redirects the tunnel traffic into a .local traffic SSL certificate. So yeah, so you can do that, but
yeah, certificates. I'm just starting to get my head around certificates. So understanding SSH and how that works is one thing, but certificates is another step, really, because it's all to do with sort of chain of trust, isn't it?
Yes.
The root certificate authorities are trusted, and the fact that they dole out certificates means that those certificates are trusted, and so on. So, whereas you can self-sign certificates, and as long as you know that it's where the certificate's coming from, then they are perfectly as safe. But the issue is, I mean, if anyone's been to a website and you see the security warning on the website, that's because the certificate isn't trusted. Well, it could be not trusted because it's self-signed, and in which case it's as secure as the trusted certificate. It just hasn't got that chain of trust. So
the other thing I've been working on this week is Exchange 2013 namespace and the HA stuff regarding that. So looking at setting up High Ability Exchange for one of our customers who've got two sites with which want to host Exchange server at each site, and they have a thing called a DAG, which is Database Ability Group, which basically means that each site has a copy of the database for Exchange. And so what happens when the user connects to their user's database is stored in this database, and that database is where the mail stores that is replicated to another Exchange server, and if that Exchange server fails, that other server's got a copy of that database on it, and that can be brought online, and the user can then have access to his emails. So what this customer has got is they've got two sites and they've got two lots of local users. So they've got local users at site A and then the local users at site B, and what will happen is that the users will connect to Exchange and then they get redirected to either site A or site B. And so you have a database on site A with site A database, and that gets replicated to site B, and then on site B they've got a database where everyone's database mailbox for site B is. They then get replicated site B to site A. Okay, and that's called a DAG, and you have to have a witness service for that because it's a cluster. You need some sort of quorum. So let's say that one of the sites completely uses WAN connections to both sites, sorry, to the quorum and the to the site B. So site A uses all its connections. You have a bit of a split brain situation where who's the master kind of thing. So because site A can't speak to site B, it could hold a live database, and then obviously B's going, well, I can't speak to A, so I'm basically going to bring site A's database up on my server. And then what happens is that you're obviously going to have two live databases. But what this third site, the quorum site, does, or the witness site, is it decides who's got the master thing. So by doing that, my situation where the WAN goes down at site A, it will obviously lose, when it loses access to the quorum, it will shut itself down, And then at the site B will go, the quorum will say, well, I've lost access to site A. Site B, can you come back up and bring this database online, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's always a problem. The problem with high availability, the way I've used it at work anyway, is you know, you always get conflicts and you know things that can't be resolved. And in the case of what we use it for at work, it's a thing called Stonith, shoot the other node in the head, which I've always loved that acronym. If it can't communicate with the other node, then it has a mechanism for shutting it down. So either shutting off the power via a UPS or whatever. We always run into problems with that. But having a third machine in the quorum is a good idea, because then it can decide and it can communicate with the live server. So I might look into that.
So it's okay if you've got equal number. If you've got equal numbers of servers, you need to have a quorum. So if you've got four servers, I think you have to have a quorum as well. So it's when you've got an odd number, it's fine, because you can have it can between the three of them. If you lose one, the two of them can just still decide which is a dead one. If you see what I mean.
All our HA stuff is in pairs. Yeah. So, but you know, if you could have a third member to decide, then that would be great.
Yeah, but this third member hasn't even got a database. All it's got is a share on it, and that just uses that to decide who's a winner, kind of thing. So I was talking about the database side of things. That's called the mailbox role, and there's another role which you have on there, which is called the CAS, which is the client access server. And with Exchange 2013, before 2013, there's a thing called RPC, which is what Exchange Outlook clients talk to Exchange on. And you might have heard
remote procedure call.
Sorry?
I think. Remote procedure
yes,
call.
Yes, is how it talks back to Exchange. With the demise of 2013, they're decommissioning that, and they're using a thing called MAPI over HTTP. And it's basically using Outlook Anywhere. So what happens is that when a client comes along and it tries and connects to Exchange, it will basically, using Auto Discover, it will ask what the OWA address is, or what the Outlook Anywhere address is. And that's this namespace business. And what you normally namespace normally is, like, it would be something like mail.admin.podcast.co.uk. And what that is, so with my example, I've got site A and site B, you'd have, but Microsoft recommends that you basically have the CAS role and the mailbox role on the same server. And what you can do is, you have a load balancer, is what you meant to have in front of them. So you put point mail.admin.podcast.co.uk to this load balancer, and then it just switch the traffic between the two sites, between the two servers, so site A and site B. And what happens is that your Outlook client gets redirected to a CAS server. And what happens when it connects to the CAS server? The CAS server goes, right, where's my mailbox stored? And the CAS server basically just proxies your request to the correct mailbox server. So the load balancer means is that if your Exchange server dies, like the site A dies, the load balancer goes, right, that server's gone down, and it redirects your traffic instantaneously to site B, and the Outlook client won't get disconnected, because the CAS is like stateless. Yeah, so it doesn't really matter it doesn't care what server it's talking to. So it's really good. So that's capability. So if the site A dies, the database falls over to the second server, and the load balancer redirects you to the correct server. But the problem is, those load balancers are quite expensive, and they don't really work over a WAN unless you get something like a global load balancer, and they're getting quite expensive. So you can use a thing called a round robin DNS. So what that would mean is that your Outlook would request a IP address, request your name, like mail.admin.podcast.co.uk, and in that DNS record you would define two IP addresses. So it'd go, right, here's my first IP address, my client A. Client B comes along and it gives you the second one, if you see what I mean. And then it goes back to giving it the first one and it gives back to giving you the second one. So it load balances the traffic between the two sites. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that all works. But the problem you've got is you need to put a low TTL on that, because what happens is if the site A dies, it doesn't automatically redirect you to site B because it's still thinking, right, I need to speak to this IP address. So a TTL is the time to live. So you'd reduce that to like 5 minutes, because that's quite good. If you have anything less than 5 minutes, it means your server is constantly pounding the DNS server. So what that means is that every 5 minutes it will go and check what the IP address is. So in a event of failure, you have to have a bit of an administrative, you have to go and take that record out of the DNS record. So take the
intervention.
Yeah, that's it. So you'd have to manually go in there and take that site A's IP address out, and then wait 5 minutes, and the client will go, oh yeah, I need my new IP address, and it will refer you to site B, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, a TTL is something with DNS, and with most things, it gives you the IP address that's associated with the name, and it says this is valid for the next 5 minutes or the next 10 minutes. So then when you're, say you go to a web page, say you go to google.com, the DNS server for google.com says this is google.com's IP address and it's valid for 10 minutes. And so if you went back to google.com, your computer would go, I already know the IP address for that, so I don't need to ask the DNS server. And if you set a low TTL, obviously it's going to be sooner before that expires, so hence it'll be hitting the servers more often.
Yeah, so that's why you have a load. But it means that the Outlook will be disconnected for 5 minutes. But I don't think that's the problem. Because not very often you're going to have a server failure. It just means that if you do like an IP config flash DNS, that will then obviously that will pick up the IP address. I don't know if anyone's seen a flaw in this yet, but because I've got site A and site B are in separate locations, which is I've got 100 meg link between the two sites, it's just that if you're on site A, right, and you go and request the IP address, the IP address from the domain name, so mail.admadminpodcast, it's going to go to DNS server, pick the IP address. It could either pick the local site A exchange server or the exchange server on site B. So you could have a problem where a user on site A is actually connecting to the exchange server at site B and their mail is their database server is at the site A. So his Outlook is going from site A all the way to site B, and then traffic going, and the site B is pulling its traffic going, your mailbox is on site A, so I'm gonna have to pull your traffic or your mail from site A to site B and then B to site A back to the client. Does that make sense?
I mean, this is exactly the reason why you have Stonith, which is to make sure that the other node isn't serving what, you know, the client thinks it's serving. So you get rid of, you put the other node out of the picture.
Yeah, right? But with Exchange, you have, where I'm using it as an active thing. So what I want to do is I want to have the people in site A access the Exchange server at site A, and the people at Exchange server site B have access to site B, because basically you have an active copy of the database at each site for the site, and the passive one is at the opposite site, if you see what I mean. So you could have a thing with a random DNS. The problem is you're going to have half your clients going to be connecting to the remote site and they're going to have their data pulled across the network, so it doesn't really work with that kind of situation where you've got the users on the same site as the exchange server. So that's called an unbound exchange namespace, but then you can do a thing called a bound namespace. And what you can do is you could have, for each site, you could have a separate namespace. So you could have site A.admin/admin podcast and site B.admin/admin podcast. And in exchange, you basically configure the URLs for that exchange server to point to those URLs. So that means that when someone on site A connects to exchange, it goes, yeah, your namespace is site A dot name site A dot admin/admin podcast.co.uk, okay, and that obviously then point the user to its internal exchange server at site A, and then site B you'd have site B dot admin/admin podcast, so that all the traffic gets redirected into itself. So that solves that problem. The problem is when it comes to failover. Is again, what you would do is that you'd, in a moment of failure, you would point it, you would redirect the DNS to the remote site, and the client would get redirected. The problem is when you have to come to fail back. And I haven't managed to find any documentation yet about how you set up this barren namespace. I've actually logged a call with Microsoft to see if they can come back to it. And apparently it's been put up to higher level to find out how to do it. So I'll come back to that. But the problem you've got with that is that because the databases are now on the other Exchange server, what happens then is that Outlook, the Exchange server, so let's say site B failed and the site B has now gone to site A, is that database on for site B, it now updates its URLs for site B, so it now puts the URLs for site B as site A. So when Outlook now boots up, it goes, where's my database? Where's my CAS namespace? It goes, yeah, you're on site A. So that means all your traffic is going to site A, okay? If you fail your database back to site B, it still thinks that you're connected, that your URLs URLs on the site A namespace, and it takes a bit of time for it to work out what the correct URLs are, and you have to have this thing called failback URLs, which means you have to go in to Exchange and do a reconfiguration work, which again it means there's a lot more work for this to get it, the failback thing, because your Outlook then is from site B is going to site A to where your CAS server is, but hang on, your database is on site B. I'm going to proxy all your requests for you back to site B. So, and also another downside is that you need to have more names in your certificate, because you're going to need to now put, you're going to have like more names in your certificate, and that's probably going to cost more money. So the other way of looking at this is what I want to speak to you about, Jerry, is that apparently what you can do is you can use a thing called GeoDNS, which is a way of redirecting people on depending on your location. So depending, which doesn't really help me for me because both the sites are in the UK. But say if you've got a UK data center and a US data center, using GeoDNS, when your PC accesses does a DNS request, it looks at what your IP address is. And it says, you're coming from a UK address. So I'm going to give you your nearest data center. So I've done a bit of a hashing about this. Is that there's a number of ways you can do this. Apparently, you can't do it with Windows DNS. There's no way. There's no third-party tool of doing this. But there is a thing called the subnet prioritization, which will basically mean if you in your A record, like I said, with like site A.admin/admin podcast or whatever. Or mail.admin/admin podcast. If your server IP address is 10.0.100.10 and your client PC is on the same subnet, so let's say it's 10.0.100.100 and you've got another site B which is 10.0.101.10 for that site B server, so there are your two records you've got 10.0.100.10 and 10.0.101.10. If your client is on 10.0.100.100, it will know that that's on the same subnet, and it will return that 10.0.100.10, and that will basically return your IP address, if you see what I mean. So that's kind of will solve your issue, but it's not very often you have your client on the same subnet as your Exchange service. That doesn't really work. The other way you can do it is apparently with Bind, which is the Linux DNS server, you can configure that to do a thing where it will, if it comes from a certain IP address range, it will redirect you, it will give you, it will look at a different host file and give you a different result. So you could, in your Bind configuration, you could list all your subnets for one site, and if your IP address is, and you come from that IP address, I'm going to look at this reference, and it means you could point yourself to site A, and if you look at your anything, you look at your site B, it goes, oh, your IP address come from site B, I'm going to refer you to this IP address. So basically, you could have the unbound model, and you could have it so that mail.admabpodcast.co.uk, so depending what IP address range you come from, Bind will give you whatever your local IP address is for whatever site you're on, if you understand that.
Well, I assume if you're in an enterprise setting, you're going to know where your sites are, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you just have to have a sort of a Bind server in the mix somewhere.
Yeah. Because normally, like I've done in the past, you have your internal AD where you have integrated DNS. We always recommend with Active Directory is that.
That's basically so that DHCP can be updated, isn't it? And all that all works nicely.
Yeah. And it also means it gets replicated nicely as well between the two sites. You haven't got a secondary and a primary before, whereas with Bind, only the primary can be updated, not the secondary. Whereas with Active Directory, with my site A and site B, you can update site B DNS record and it will get replicated to site A and then vice versa.
Yeah. So I guess you'd have your Exchange servers and so on in different subnets just so you can play around with location stuff.
Yeah. And so I don't really want to have to set up a Bind server just to do this, because normally with this namespace is that you it's not your same domain name as what your internal name is, it's something else. Normally something it's like it's your email alias kind of thing. So what you can do is that you could set up in your, this is how I'm going to do it for this customer, is that each site's got a DNS server and you basically create a zone at each site for that domain name. So you create a zone called mail.admin.podcast.co.uk at each site, but you don't create an AD integrated zone, which basically means it doesn't get replicated to the other side, which means that each site you'd have a zone record which you can modify, and you can basically point them, the A records, to your local Exchange server. So site A would have one which points to site A Exchange, and site B will be basically pointing to the Exchange server at site B. And with DHCP, what I would do is each site gets given what the local DNS server are. So site A would be given the DNS servers at site A, and site B would be given the DNS servers at site B. So when they do that query, it will go, right, I want site A, and I'm going to have to pull that, what's that IP address for that site, and it's going, oh yeah, it's this site IP address. And that means that then I've kind of done a cheap way of doing it without having to buying a load balancer or setting up Bind, if that makes sense.
Sounds like a good solution.
So that's my interesting thing, my week really. So the other thing I was going to say about was just that I found out this week about the little kip in Windows 8.1. it's really annoying to go down to shut to log off or shut down the machine. Apparently if you press Windows I, it will bring the in Windows 8, it will bring the thing on the left hand, on the right hand side, sorry, and it brings there's like a bar what's coming up on the right side, and you can basically log off easily, or you can shut down, or you get to the control panel. Because it's annoying, because if it's not, you have to get your mouse, go into the bottom corner, then it brings this little setting thing, and you click on that, and then you can click on power down. A quick shortcut to also do it is apparently if you're Windows D, which basically means that you put everything, minimises everything to desktop, and then do Alt F4, it brings a classic shutdown thing. So
how does it from there? Yeah. I love keyboard shortcuts. Saves so much time.
And Windows L, I use it all the time to lock the machine. Do you have to press Control D to lock the machine? Just press Windows L, it locks it straight away. So
Windows L, Windows M, that minimises everything. I think that's the same as Windows D. I don't know what the difference is, Windows D and Windows
I think it's slightly different. You press Windows D and it you get the desktop, and then you press it again and you get everything back. Whereas Windows M just minimises everything, and you can't then get it back. You have to...
But it's right, if you're on desktop mode, then you do Alt-F4, then that's... what you're doing then is telling us to close Explorer then, aren't you? That's... Mm. That's where it starts to shut down.
I've never actually used Windows 8 for any longer than about 5 minutes.
Well, so. It's absolutely fine. It's just like Windows 7, but it just doesn't use the start menu at all. I just have everything pinned down on my bottom. You don't use it. The only thing when you first boot it up in Windows 8, it goes straight to the Metro screen, and you have to press the desktop. And then annoyingly, it's a bit different. Annoyingly, I'm running Windows 8 Enterprise on my laptop. And apparently there's no... If you're running Windows 8 at home, you can upgrade to Windows 8.1 by going to the store and then downloading it. But because I'm running Windows 8 Enterprise, you can't go to 8.1. There's no direct path from Windows 8 to 8.1 Enterprise. The only way you can do it is by completely trashing your machine and setting it up from scratch. And I just haven't got the time at the moment to do that.
Really?
Good God.
If you're running Windows 8.18 at home, it's not a problem, or professional. But if you're running 8 Enterprise, which I'm running, there's no upgrade path from 8 to 8.1 for some reason.
Okay. That's bizarre.
My daughter wants to get a Windows laptop at some point. She's tired of not having any Windows in the house.
We've finally got a Twitter account. If anyone wants to follow us on Twitter, I didn't realise, but you can't have admin in the name at all, and you can't even you can't have admin in the actual display name either.
Maybe that's the username and password for the whole Twitter account.
So if you want to follow us, it's I basically shorted it down to ADM. At ADM podcast. I heard that from the other podcast which I mentioned the other day on there, and we had a nice email from, didn't we, Jerry?
Sysadministrivia, was it? Yeah.
I got wrong for presenting it. I completely got the name wrong completely.
I got the pronunciation
wrong, so.
Yeah, there's this thing called administrivia. It's like, little bits of work that you have to do for something. Administrivia. And sysadmin, obviously. Obviously, we're all sysadmin.
Yeah. So we might have had some new listeners for that this week, hopefully, maybe. They said they were going to maybe put us on the podcast, on the link to us in the show notes. So,
I can see at the moment our Twitter account's got exactly one tweet and exactly one follower. And that it looks like quite an unlikely follower to me. What is it, Gloria someone? Oh no, it's Dolores Z now. Gloria, whoever, stop following it. It's Dolores Z now. Oh. So.
Let's see if we can add to that by next week.
Yeah. We will actually put some content on there as well, so we'll do a few tweets. Yeah.
I think we're there, aren't we, for this week?
Yeah,
we're over the hour, definitely over the hour. So so I'll have to report back next time.
Good luck tomorrow.
I was going to say, if either one of you are on Facebook or somewhere tomorrow, or whether you'll do a runner or something.
As usual on the Saturdays, I'm ferrying the kids around the Sussex.
Yeah. So. Any problem, just give us a message on the thing or whatever. Whatever.
I was going to mention one more thing. You mentioned, Andy, you're talking about, Al, you're talking about Link. Have either of you heard of Slack? I mean, it's a service, it's an external service, but it kind of combines messaging and email, but. It seems to be it's one of those things you can't work out how they're making any money. But
right, okay. No, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I've heard of people using it. People mention it, you know, like developers sort of use it. But it kind of combines messaging and email, and it's searchable. Maybe we could use it for the podcast. I don't know, but yeah, probably worth a look. Something I haven't looked at.
What I have been using as well, which is really good, is I'm not going to have to just pronounce it. I'm going to go off my links. Is like I was using, I can't remember what I was using now for my list. I think it's like any.do to do for my list thing. But I'm now using Trello. Is it Trello?
I've heard of that. I've not used it. I use Evernote, but I have heard of Trello.
It's absolutely brilliant. I use it all the time. Now I've got like four boards: work stuff, home stuff, and like the admin stuff. And when I was thinking of something to put on there, I just put it on there. Or it's just really good. So it's free. So, and there's a paid version again. But like I know companies use it like for calibration, not whatever you call it, coloration kind of thing. So, yeah. It's good. All right, well, if you want to mail us, you can email us, mail@admin.co.uk, or you can go onto the website and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus now. So, yes.
We finally made it to all the different social networks.
Yes. Good. All right, well, we'll see you all soon, guys.
See you next time.
See you later.